we're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is Tom Alvarez, co-producer of the Jewel Box Review 2022, which is debuting this week at the Indie Fringe Festival. The Jewel Box Review 2022 is an homage to the original Jewel Box Review, a multiracial troupe of female impersonators that toured across the United States during the mid-20th century. We'll be discussing the history of the Jewel Box Review, and I'll be sharing some rare recordings featuring performances by the original Jewel Box cast. We'll also discuss Tom's history-making career in Indianapolis media. Tom has worked as an actor, model, writer, and director. His journey began over 50 years ago when Tom was hired by WRTV6, becoming the first on-air Latino broadcaster in Indianapolis television. Tom stayed at WRTV for 15 years, producing 25 primetime specials for the station. And Tom continued his work in television after leaving WRTV, producing and directing Emmy Award-winning content for his own company, The Alvarez Group. In addition to his work in theater, Tom currently appears as a regular contributor on Wish TV's Lifestyle Live. And he writes an online column titled On the Isle with Tom Alvarez. We'll be discussing all of this and more on this week's show. So let's join my conversation with Tom Alvarez. Tom, thank you so much for being here today. I'm excited to talk with you.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. I have to say that I am a huge fan and a regular listener. Your interviews are just top-notch, and your subject matter, I have learned so much from you over the years, and of course we have so much in common.
I appreciate you for saying that.
So it's a pleasure to be here.
Likewise. And we're going to talk about your latest production today, the Jewel Box Review 2022, which is produced through Magic Thread Cabaret. You're going to have a series of performances throughout the month of August and September. I'll give folks all those details throughout the program tonight. But first, I wanted to talk a little about your background. You have a historic career here in Indianapolis media. You started out in the 1970s, I believe. And to my knowledge, you were the first television broadcaster of Latin American descent in Indianapolis.
That's right. Is that true? And I went looking for some proof of that not too long ago, just out of curiosity. And I called some colleagues of mine who are Latino just to sort of make sure that I wasn't speaking out of turn. And it appears that I was on a public affairs show, which was live every Saturday for a couple of years. That's how I got my foot in the door. They recruited me, found me in Fort Wayne. This was all had to do with affirmative action, and WRTV wanted to hire someone to be on the air who was of Latino descent at that time. The doors had just begun to open in Indianapolis for people of color to be on the air. So I was on the Saturday show, and it was sponsored by the Indiana State Employment Security Division. I was like an early Vanna White. I would point to job descriptions. And the host was Russ Freeland, a really well-known African-American entrepreneur, former ABA basketball player. So we were a team. So that was my first gig on television. And one day I walked into the control room and saw that this is really where I'm going to be. This is where the creativity happens. So that's how I got my foot in the door. But I was there as a producer-director for like 14 years. Mm.
And you mentioned that they recruited you out of Fort Wayne, mm-hmm. and that's where you grew up, correct?
I did. Born and raised in Fort Wayne, Indiana, graduate of Central Catholic High School, and I went to college there at the Indiana University, Purdue University campus, majored in theater at Purdue Indiana Theater, which was just an excellent school. And you know, I give them all the credit for any success I've had since.
And Tom, you grew up in Indiana at a time when the Latin American Hispanic community was very small, right? There was a population in northern Indiana, and there was a small population here in Indianapolis as well in the 60s and 70s.
But
it was
indeed.
Very small. Yeah, tell us about kind of the cultural atmosphere of the world you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in Fort Wayne because my parents settled there, one of the first Latino families to settle in the Midwest. They were migrant workers, and farm workers, and they traveled from their home in San Antonio every year to the Midwest to pick crops. And as the story goes, you know, they always encountered really kind farmers who were very generous and respectful. And yet, you know, my mother was determined to leave the poverty and racism that they experienced in Texas behind. And she wanted, it was a classic immigrant story, but, you know, we weren't separated by an ocean from the old country. It was just Texas. But they were one of the first families to settle, and they chose Fort Wayne because it was near a farm where they had their last gig, if you will. And my mother was bound to determine, you know, that her kids would be raised in the Midwest because she just had a sense we would get a good education, a better education. Of course, it all proved to be true. So that's my background. My parents were migrant workers. I was the first in my family to go to college. I have 7 brothers and a sister. Of course, we're all older now. And one of my oldest brother passed away recently, but the rest of us are still alive and well, scattered all over the country. And I moved here, as I said, to pursue a career in broadcasting. And of course, that's a whole story. But suffice to say, it was a Mexican-American business owner in Fort Wayne who took me under his wing. He was a very successful restaurateur. And he was on a advisory committee for Channel 6. And I told you earlier, they were looking for a Latino presence on the air. One day I was telling him that I had this dream of breaking into broadcasting. He said, well, it just so happens. So it was kind of a really magical story. And it was the help of this mentor, patron, if you will, that I found myself in Fort Wayne or in Indianapolis. And by the way, I went to all the broadcasting outlets in Fort Wayne before I came to Indy to see if I could, you know, find a job. But most of them said, well, kid, you know, you might start by sweeping the floor in a radio station. And maybe, just maybe, you might be able to work your way up. So,
and what was this gentleman's name that assisted you?
Jose Treviño. He was a Mexican immigrant, and he opened, I think, 3 or 4 very successful restaurants, and a really tremendous, intelligent, bright, energetic presence in my life when I was a really young man. He believed in me, you know, and ever since then I've tried to emulate him, and I love giving breaks to young people. I love that.
And Tom, what year was it that you came to Indianapolis?
I think around 1971 or 2. I didn't come directly from Fort Wayne. I had left Fort Wayne. I dropped out of college, by the way, because I had a brother who returned from Vietnam War, and we were very close. And I asked him, can I come and live with you? Because I want to get out of Dodge. I want to leave Indiana. I want to broaden my history. So I moved to Washington, D.C., and I spent 2 years there. That opened my world up like nobody's business. I worked in a bank. That's how I put myself through school. And the story goes that my story is that I worked in this bank in Bethesda, and across the street was a TV station. And one of my customers was Connie Chung, who was a young producer. And she used to talk to me and my teller friend next to me in the booth, Tony, about, you know, her job. And she said, we both were kind of like thinking about what we really wanted to do. And it wasn't being bank tellers. She said, you should really think about broadcasting because opening up for minorities. So I planted that seed in my head. After 2 years, I had to move back to Fort Wayne. And that's when I, you know, I did other things until the time I met my mentor. So that's Connie Chung is indirectly responsible for my
that's
career.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And of course, you know, she's retired now, but then she was a young, ambitious, driven young reporter. I just never forget that. Isn't that a great story?
It's fantastic. Yeah. And you had a really successful career at Channel 6. You produced award-winning television content, correct?
I did. Yeah. I actually produced 25 what we called specials. They were half-hour, prime-time TV programs, and they gave me a lot of freedom. I look back, and I'm amazed at the budgets that I was able to work in, the equipment I was able to rent. But, you know, my shows are really successful because they sold them advertisers and they aired in prime time. And they were mostly about social issues. And I was the first producer locally or anywhere nationally to do a special on Madam Walker. Mm. And I'm really proud of that. And I think, you know, I also did
David Baker.
I did a documentary about Indiana the jazz legacy at Indiana Avenue that was hosted by, the legendary anchor. I'm blanking.
Not Barbara Boyd.
No. He. I'll think of it in a minute.
From Channel 6?
Yes, at Channel
Not
6.
Not Caldwell?
Howard Caldwell.
Yeah, Howard Caldwell.
Lovely man, yeah. So I worked most of my documentaries. It was my idea to use the news talent to host these things, and no one had thought about doing that before. So, yeah, After a while, I did specials almost exclusively, but for the most part, I was like, there was a staff of producers, and we did everything. We did all the public affairs shows, Focus on Faith. And for years, I signed the station on. I had to wake up at 3:30 in the morning to be there at 5.
Yeah.
And Harry Martin, his farm show, for a long time, I directed that.
And Tom, you mentioned knocking on the doors of radio stations in Fort Wayne, looking for opportunity, and they told you to think about sweeping the floor.
Yeah.
I'm curious if, after you arrived in Indianapolis at WRTV, if your identity as a Latino interfered or interrupted or hurt your ability to work there? Did you experience any racism or were you
it
not taken
It was subtle,
seriously?
But yeah. I did. Yeah. I did, and I'm very frank about that now. You know, you have to walk in one's shoes, and because my story is unique and only unique, my parents chose not to teach us Spanish. They faced discrimination and racism in Texas in a more direct way than I ever did. But part of that, they were both, my mother tells the story of being punished in school for speaking Spanish. So she was determined that we would fit in, we would assimilate. And they didn't want us to learn, they wanted us to focus on learning English, to be educated, so that we wouldn't have to face the kind of prejudice. So I think that in many ways gave me privilege that a lot of Latinos don't have. My education, and I never have lost sight of that. But I did feel the brunt of some really subtle racism on the part of people. I think it had more to do. Many of the people I worked with, I could tell that they really resented that I got in the door by way of affirmative action. I could feel that. I really had to work to prove myself, especially as a director. I was in charge of all these people. But I finally, you know, I was pretty soft-spoken and pretty timid, but eventually I found my way and I asserted myself. And from that point on, I did okay. But initially, I really had to battle to get their respect. Mm. And, of course, at the time, you know, I'm gay. And at the time, I was deeply in the closet because I could feel just from the comments of everybody, you know, this was like the 70s, so in Indiana. So, you know, racism, homophobia, and sexism was rampant. And I thought that being in broadcasting, I'd be in a really liberal atmosphere, but no, it was anything. But maybe the reporters and some of the people in management, but not the people that I worked with, engineers mostly, blue collar. Though, you know, upper middle class, they were, you know, they had very conservative views, and I could feel that. And it was tough. It kept me in the closet until I left, and that's one of the reasons I left. I felt that it was too restrictive, and I wanted to explore. And I really didn't come out but then I had to really keep it. But you know, I was a product of my generation too. You know, although when I lived in Washington, I jumped out of the closet, but I had to go back in when I moved back to Indiana. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Tom, before the interview, you mentioned that two sort of defining aspects of your identity are being a Latino and being a gay man. And I did want to ask you about your experience as a gay man in Indianapolis during the 70s and 80s, a time when this was when people were forced in the closet for either professional reasons or because they might be ostracized from their families or certain parts of society.
Well, people were getting fired in those days, mm-hmm. and I don't think bars were being raided in. But I was so closeted. You know, for me, it was just a fear that I would lose this job that I had. For the longest time, I identified myself with what I was, like a lot of men did. And, of course, I was in this rarefied position. You know, when people would introduce me, it was like, oh, this is Tom. He works at Channel 6. So I had to – there was a real cachet to it. There still is. People still remember me from working and still remember from being an heir. And so, yes, it still carries cachet that I worked in broadcasting. So but, you know, being in the closet I didn't really emerge, as I said, until I left after those 15 years, and I started my own business, and, you know, I started finding my way, and I started being more open about my life. I don't consider, you know, the term lifestyle as a pejorative to me. That's silly. I mean, this is not lifestyle. This is this is who I am. Mm. And so it was a period of growth, but, you know, every gay person has a different journey, a different story. You know, we're not monolithic. Who is?
And, Tom, we'll get into more of some of your experiences here in the gay nightlife scene of Indianapolis during the 70s, but I did have one final question about your work in broadcasting. I'm curious how you feel about the state of representation in the contemporary media landscape of Indianapolis. There are now, you know, full-time Spanish language radio stations. You are seeing Hispanic commentators integrated more into local news broadcasts. Any thoughts on the changes over the last 40 years?
I am just beyond thrilled, even in the local broadcasting scene, to see the representation of Latinos, Asians, and, of course, even, you know, age is part of diversity, although I think that there's still a bit of that. But I think Indianapolis has got a great report card going for. I'm just thrilled to see, you know, black anchors and, you know, African-American weather people in major positions, you know. Yes, I was at Channel 6 when Barbara Boyd was the first African-American reporter, and she's a dear friend of mine, and I haven't seen her for a while, but, you know, she's elevated to, like, icon status, as she should be. But now it's pretty common. And, you know, most African-American broadcasters I know still review, look at Barbara as having been, like, the, you know, she's a saint to many, and even to me, you know, because she really helped take me under my wing, and I would go to her at certain times, you know, to sort of gain from her knowledge and strength, because she, you know, she helped a lot of people. And so, yes, I think the representation is great. It was a long time coming. And, you know, it just reflects our society and who we are and the diverse racial makeup. And I happen to know that there are also openly gay broadcasters on the air who used to say, I don't talk about my private life, but, you know, what is that? I have several openly gay friends in broadcasting. It's just not an issue to anybody.
I I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. If you're just tuning in, my guest this week is Tom Alvarez. We've been discussing his historic career in Indianapolis media. For the remainder of this week's show, we'll be discussing Tom's work in theater, specifically his latest production, The Jewel Box Review 2022, which is debuting this Thursday, August 18th, at the Indie Fringe Festival. Performances run until September 2nd, and you can find showtimes and purchase tickets online at indiefringe.org. The Jewel Box Review 2022 is a product of the Magic Thread Cabaret, a collaboration between Tom Alvarez and Dustin Klein. Let's return to my conversation with Tom Alvarez as he discusses his creative partnership with Dustin Klein. We're going to talk about the Jewel Box Review, your latest theatrical production. This is being presented by the Magic Thread Cabaret,
yes,
which is an organization you co-founded with artistic director
Dustin Klein. We call it
Dustin
a brand.
Klein, a brand you
because
co-founded.
Because we have a production company.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Klein
yeah.
and Alvarez Productions. Yeah. Dustin and I have been producing partners. He's my collaborator, my creative soulmate. I definitely want to talk about Dustin. He is a theater choir teacher. He's been at the Orchard School for 20 years. We met at a Christmas party 7 years ago, almost eight now, in a corner of a crowded room. We started talking and, you know, fast forward to now, we've been together as collaborators now ever since. And we started our journey as creative soulmates with producing Calder the Musical. It was an original musical that we co-created. He wrote the music and I wrote the lyrics. It was based on the life of Alexander Calder, the sculptor. We've been hoping to take it to other markets, but, you know, things change and happen. And eventually we wanted to stay together, something that was more short term. And we both love cabaret. So I said, let's do some cabaret shows. So we started Magic Thread Cabaret. And for about 3 years, we did full seasons at the Cat up in Carmel. And our mission is to showcase local artists, local musicians. There are a lot of people in musical theater who are non-professionals, great people who sing or and singers in all arenas, but cabaret is an art form, and we are an incubator. We, if you will, we develop these talent, and we help them produce, in fact, produce cabaret shows. And we can provide soup to nuts. We can help with their set list, a theme. You know, of course, we have the venue. We produce, we direct, you know, we can, we do the whole nine yards. We raise the money. It's what producers do. We do the marketing. We package their shows so that they walk away from Magic Red Cabaret. They have done a cabaret act, which they could then, you know, continue on if they choose to. So, you know, we've been able to successfully develop a number of young, talented artists. And then COVID came, and like everybody else, you know, we had to shut down. And then we regrouped and decided that that model wasn't the best for us. We couldn't sustain it. Dustin has a full-time job. And, of course, you know, I do lots of things. I'm on a TV show. I have an online column and, of course, Magic Thread Cabaret. But want to continue with the cabaret. So we're gonna do a fringe show every year and do whatever comes along. We've been very, very fortunate though that we have great supporters and been really good at fundraising. So we've got exciting plans ahead.
My guest this week is Tom Alvarez, co-producer of the Jewel Box Review 2022. We'll return to my conversation with Tom in a moment. But first, let's hear a rare recording from Lynn Carter, one of the original stars of the Jewel Box Review. From the 1960 album, She's a He, this is Lynn Carter with Repertoire.
Meet and greet Mr. Lynn Carter.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I know what you're expecting, Arms. You expect me to get dirty right away, but you keep the record spinning because, oh, I'm going to rip it off the wall later on. You wait, you catch up with me. I'll tell you, we're going to rip it off the wall. You wait. I was just talking to my girlfriend the other day, and I was telling her, you said, you know how you talk about your repertoire. You have to have a very smart repertoire, and some of the joints I work in, honey, repertoire is everything. In fact, I was discussing repertoires with this girl, and I was pointing out about people, you know, famous people and their repertoires, and, well, I was discussing, you know, pro and con about these people, and you know something, darling? Now, I'll be very blunt. Tell me, why is Alfred Lunt still a big box office star? Well, it isn't his build or the dear theater guild. It's the size of his repertoire. You know, from Moscow to Bolivia, they adore Laurence Olivier. Now tell me, why do you think he got so very far? Now they don't believe all they say. It wasn't Miss Vivian Lee. Miss Vivian Leigh. It's the length of his repertoire. Today the public's fickle. You know, so there's just a mere trickle of stars they truly idolize. But alas, so be it. You know, they know a repertoire when they see it. Of course, I'm referring to quality, not size. And how about Tallulah? Making all that moolah, living on champagne and caviar. Through her efforts, excessive. You know what? She's developed a most impressive and glamorous repertoire. You can see it any night in Las Vegas or tune in on television. Now, how about Mae West and that dazzling diamond chest? Well, you got to admit, this child went very, very far. And you know, it wasn't by looking dreamy or saying, well, y'all come up and see me. Frankly, I've seen it. Oh, honey, this child has got a fabulous, hit it again for May, honey, repertoire. There are many illustrations, folks who are sensations, like Elvis and his twanging guitar. But let's get down to cases. He's a hit on this basis. It's the way he handles. Oh, honey, you got a wicked mind, child. His repertoire. The moral to this ditty is you don't have to be pretty with talents that are spectacular. You can take the road to fame and make yourself a name. I wonder what kind of a name that would be. Something with a four-letter word. I don't know. By developing, oh, enlarging. Yeah, I forgot that other word I was going to use on the record. Your repertoire.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the actor, model, writer, and director, Tom Alvarez. Tom is the co-producer of the Jewel Box Revue 2022, an homage to the original Jewel Box Revue, a multiracial troupe of female impersonators that toured across the United States during the mid-20th century.
The Jewel Box Review 2022 is debuting this Thursday, August 18th, at the Indie Fringe Festival. Performances run until September 2nd. You can find showtimes and purchase tickets online at indiefringe.org. We'll return to my conversation with Tom Alvarez in just a moment. But first, let's hear another vintage recording from a performer associated with the Jewel Box Review. From the album, You're Stepping on My Eyelashes, this is Ray Bourbon with Back in Drag Again.
My dears, you should simply see the wonderful gown that I'm wearing. It's a wonderfully sparkling thing, all loaded with rhinestones. Beautiful, beautiful skirt. 168 yards of the damnedest things you've ever seen in your life. In fact, it cuts the low what it does and short points at, and you'd love it. And I'm wearing an upsweep wig that would drive you out of your mind, and a mink coat dragon. And Mary, if you don't think dragon mink ain't something, get one on. I'm tired of suppressing the desire I have for dressing the way I've always felt I should. I have no business in sack suits or even in slack suits. So I've taken off my pants and for good. Oh, I'm back in drag again, and I love it. It's where I should always have been. Me and the models at Harper's and Vogue, we're sisters over the skin. Oh, I'm back in drag again, and you can see it from my head clear down to my toes. But I get out of line somewhere in between, well, there's a thorn on every rose. Now, I've improved upon the works of Mother Nature. I know some things that old gal forgot. I've always done a good job being what I am. But I do a better job being what I'm not. I was never meant to be a tailor's dummy. You can see damn well what I was meant to be. So I'll be a lady if it kills me. And I'll go to hell in mink, I'll guarantee. Oh, I'm back in drag again. I hope it's perfect. Perfume, jewels, curls. But I've frightened away some of my oldest friends. They just can't seem to go for us girls. Well, I was good enough to stump the experts and win a prize on Information Please. But they can't make up their minds where to use me on those walking man or those Miss Hush mysteries. So if anything I wear is double-breasted, it's not going to be the jacket of a suit. To hell with those shirts and seven little buttons. I can squeeze into this mess and look boot. Now, I've never felt my best in pants or T-shirts. I don't like to wear suspenders or belts. I don't like getting into BVDs or shorts, unless they're on somebody else. And even where you'd think it makes a difference whether I'm dressed up as a he or a she, I don't even stop to think about it because I always sit down to pour tea. So it's me for the furs and the satins. The men and the lesbots can have those old ideas. So I'm back in drag and gonna stay there. There isn't even a zipper a fly on me.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is Tom Alvarez, co-producer of the Jewel Box Review 2022. Let's return to our conversation. And we're going to spend some time talking about your latest production, which is Jewel Box Review 2022. And the subject of this piece is a troupe of female impersonators that were founded in 1939, I believe, the Jewel Box Review. They toured across the United States during the 40s, 50s, and 60s and were a tremendously popular nightclub act. They played at the Apollo, New York, and big theaters across the country. You know, beyond the entertainment value of the Jewel Box Review, this group was really important for a variety of reasons, culturally and even politically, you might say. Not only was this a group of gay entertainers that were traveling the United States at a time when this community was being harassed, persecuted, and marginalized. They were also a racially mixed ensemble at a time when that was not common in mainstream entertainment or even in nightclubs, neighborhood nightclubs. You know, there were Latino, Black, I think even some Asian performers that worked with the ensemble over the years. So this is an incredibly important part of American entertainment history. And you're bringing this name back, the history of the Jewel Box Review, for this production. Tell us why. Why did you focus on the Jewel Box Review for this production, what it means to you?
And as your fellow broadcaster, this is why I love your show so much. And I'm so, I so respect you because you do your homework.
Thank you.
You really do. I don't know where to begin. I went to Finocchio's.
You saw the Jewel Box.
A legendary drag venue that I think it began in 1936 and they finally shut down in 1999. So, of course, I made a pilgrimage there during one of my first trips to San Francisco, which, you know, for a gay guy, it's just like a Catholic going to Rome. Of course I had to go to Finocchio's. And so I saw the Jewel Box Review in their waning days, like in the early 70s, and I was completely captivated. I was blown away at this troupe of female impersonators. Up to that point, I had seen lip-sync drag. With all due respect to lip-sync drag performers, I in no way denigrate. That is a separate art form. It's a different art form. But, of course, a valid. So they're apples and oranges. I have to make that clear. But to see these men create this illusion, to see them complete this illusion. And, of course, now I'm a reviewer. So for years, I have judged art based on its seamlessness and been an arbiter. And if I can get lost completely in the artist and what they're doing, that to me is success. That is illusion making at its best. And they were, you know, and of course, their production values, the costumes, the makeup, the live music, everything. And of course, by then I had seen a few Broadway shows, and I was just really excited and amazed. And so a year ago, we were standing with Justin Brady, who runs Indie French, in front of his theater, and we were talking about the festival. And I said, is there a drag show in the festival this year? He says, no, and surprisingly, there's not. So that's when the light switch went on, and that was a year ago. And immediately I had the thought, the Jewel Box Review, wouldn't it be cool if we did an homage? And so that's, it took a year, but that's where we are right now.
And Tom, we were talking before the interview about how this is the perfect time to kind of revisit the Jewel Box Review, because so much of what they represented is important to people today. And I'm curious if, to a large degree, they've kind of been forgotten. Do you find that people in the community, generally speaking, remember the Jewel Box Review and are familiar with the name?
Well, you know, of course, Dustin and I have been talking about it for a year, and I can say no, for the most part, except for a few people like our costumer, Stephen Hollenbach. He's just incredibly talented. He knew a Jewel Box Review performer. So, of course, he came to us and said, I'd really like to be involved because I know all about this company and I really am excited about what you guys are doing. But generally, no. And it's been a lot of fun educating people about this company. People are just like really intrigued, as they should be. We have four female impersonators, one male impersonator, because they also had a male impersonator.
Stormé,
Yes, Stormé, who was mixed race. Her father was a very wealthy white man. Her mother was black. She was a singer, a baritone, apparently incredibly. Her voice was just stunning. Unfortunately, no one has heard any recordings of her. Maybe you have.
Maybe this would be a good time to slip in a live recording of Stormé performing in the, this would be in the early 80s.
Yeah, but
I do have one, yes.
You do?
Yeah, I am going to slip one in
on
the program.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
Let's pause and listen to a rare live recording from the Jewel Box Review vocalist and male impersonator, Stormé. This is Stormé singing There Will Never Be Another You.
There will another fall, another spring, but there will never be another you. There will be other lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. Yes, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true? If there will never
I slow down, they'll be sprinkling my ashes to the four winds.
That was Stormé with There Will Never Be Another You. That recording was featured in director Michelle Parkerson's 1987 documentary, Stormé, The Lady of the Jewel Box. Let's return to my conversation with Tom Alvarez, co-producer of the Jewel Box Review 2022, which is debuting this week at the Indie Fringe Festival. Earlier, I was talking about the social and cultural importance of the Jewel Box Review. What about that history appeals to you? What about that spoke to you?
Okay, well,
beyond the
number one, I majored in theater. I'm an actor. I've over 40 years, I've been reviewing everything. I've seen the best in musical theater. I've seen the best in cabaret. It just appeals to me from the standpoint of live entertainment. And then there's the whole art form itself, the whole idea of it creating illusion. Men dressing as women has been going on for centuries, starting with the Greeks and probably earlier than that. There's a third sex in Native American culture, where men dressed as women, right? So it's been here. There's a visual that we're going to use in the show. We're going to be airing some of these archival photographs of the company of Jewel Box Review, and we have this one visual of them all lined up with the founders Doc and Danny, who were lovers. Oh, by the way, I have to point out, this is one of the first LGBT communities, because they were gay men who owned and operated this group of queer artists, and they were not exploiting them. They were holding them up and elevating them as really being important. And they did that by providing them with the best production values and elements that they could. It was class. It was family friendly. Of course, that's a whole nother topic. You asked why it appeals to me.
Yeah.
Just the lengths that they went to create this illusion, and to do it with such style and glamour, and to also make it entertaining. And the fact that they played to mostly straight audience just amuses me to no end. But, and indirectly what they did, though, was open the door for acceptance. And
right.
Look, because look where we are right now, RuPaul's Drag Race. you know, which has been seen by millions all over the world.
Yeah.
And,
you know, the fact that they toured the United States, I think, is really what made them such a cultural phenomenon. If they'd stayed in New Orleans or stayed in New York or stayed in California, it might not have had that, you know, it might not have created that community that you're
referring
to.
In the show, we talk about some of the places they went to. They went to little towns like Hobbs, New Mexico, and like Alpena, I think it was Wisconsin. And, you know, we found some images of these small towns. So they, you know, can you imagine playing in some of those little towns in like the 30s, 40s, and 50s? It's just, it's a remarkable story.
And on that topic, Tom, I wanted to talk about, you know, the fact that the Jewel Box Revue did perform in Indianapolis several times during the 1960s. And I believe the first venue they played at was the Pink Poodle nightclub on Indiana Avenue, which was Aretha Franklin played there. Local jazz stars like Jimmy Coe played there. This was a famous local nightclub. It later became, it went through a variety of changes in the 60s and eventually became the famous Door. And in the late 60s and early to mid 70s, this was sort of the premier drag club in Indianapolis. And you told me you had the opportunity to patronize the famous Door on Indiana Avenue. Tell me about this.
Well, after I returned home to Fort Wayne after my 2 years in Washington, I was, quote, out of the closet. And my first visit to a drag club in Washington, D.C., I don't recall going to a drag club there, but when I got to Fort Wayne, I found myself one night at Up the Street, and the owner was called Tulisa. And Tulisa was, and she's still performing as far as I know. His name was Charles. I'm blanking on his last name, but his club up the street is where I saw my first drag shows, and, you know, I was hooked. And one night, a group of friends, we made who had a road trip and came to Indy, and we went to the famous Door, and oh my gosh, it was just unbelievable. It was, and the hostess, I wish I could remember her name, but she was just that classic kind of acerbic, sarcastic, kind of had that comedic kind of vibe that she could improv, and the things that she said on her toes. It was just so much fun. It was just so much fun. So yeah, the famous Door. It's a shame that it doesn't exist, you know.
So your production of the Jewel Box Revue is informed by decades of firsthand experience with this art form and with a firsthand experience with the Jewel Box Revue itself. So
and
you're bringing a lot
more.
Of, yeah.
And
go
this
ahead.
Is why I'm going
yeah.
to give you an exclusive. Yeah. I performed a drag 3 times. I donned a dress and heels, and this was for, these were for fundraisers for the Damien Center, and they were put on by members of the gay recovery community. I'm in recovery and have been. I've been sober and clean for many, many years. And they asked me to do it, and I thought, why not? So I have been in drag, and I sang. So having performed myself, now is that something I would do on a regular basis? No, because it's a lot of trouble. But if you're going to do it, I had to do it with perfection. I had the wig, the makeup, and you know, I even shave. Yeah, so yeah, I shave my legs. I admit it, but I'm a perfectionist, so why not?
So you have a lot of experience with this art form as a
spectator
well, and now you know, as a participant. Right?
One thing that we haven't talked about up until the time Doc and Danny came around, it had already been happy, but drag had always been mocked. But the Jewel Box Revue gave their performers. They gave them dignity, and again, they elevated the art form so that these performers were taken as seriously as if people were going to go to a Broadway show. That just contributed to, I think, their own self-esteem, and for many gay people, you know, they felt defined by what society thought about them and bought into all of that shame and all of that sort of stuff.
And Tom, as I mentioned, you have this rich history and background as a spectator and participant in this culture, and you're bringing all that experience and knowledge to your production of the Jewel Box Revue 2022 at Indie Fringe. And you've assembled a cast of performers here in Indianapolis that reflects the diversity of the original Jukebox.
Yes.
You have Latin, Black performers in the cast. You have a sitting Indianapolis City County Councilman,
sure,
Keith
do.
Potts, participating. Tell us about the cast of the ensemble.
Well, Keith,
and, yeah, the cast and
Keith
how you put
Potts,
the ensemble together.
You know, Keith Potts, he's actually one of the performers that Dustin and I developed and you know, presented his own cabaret show. He is a Boston Conservatory graduate. We have two equity performers, by the way. So Keith is a very, very talented, and then there's Isaiah Moore, who starred in the Phoenix Theater production of Magnolia Ballet, and that's where I saw him. I said, I've got to get him in our show. And initially, we didn't think he could do our show because he, too, is an equity actor, but Keith and Isaiah both are courtesy of Actors Equity through a special performance contract. And then we have Jim Melton, who is our ingenue. Jim is actually our only, quote, real drag queen, doesn't act. And his drag name is Madison Avenue. Jim is just a tremendous performer, great comedian, if you will. And then lastly, we have Irv Gaynor, who is really well known in the musical theater community, young African-American performer, and he's been a delight to work with. Triple Threat, they're all triple threats. They all sing and dance, and then we have two dancers who have also co-choreographed the show, Jade Perry and Xavier Medina, who is my Mexican-American brother, and both of them, Jade, at one time danced with the Disney organization in Paris and Florida. He's now a realtor, but, you know, he still dances on the side. And Xavier teaches ballroom and all kinds of salsa and jazz. And we are on a smaller scale, but we are really trying to mirror what the Jukebox Revue did. So you're going to get a taste of a production that we've gone to great lengths. Hair and makeup by Bailey Lewis, who is an IU grad theater, and he's worked with the Indiana Repertory Theater, and that's who, in fact, recommended him. And, of course, Steve Hollenbeck's been costuming everybody in town and around the country for, like, 40 years. And so you're going to see costumes, makeup, and hair that I think comes pretty close to the standards that the original Jukebox would approve of. Yeah.
Is there any aspect of this production that I haven't asked you about that you wanted to share with people?
You know, it's meant to be entertaining. I wrote the script, but, you know, I inserted some commentary that makes it clear that, you know, the message is it's an entertaining show. But, you know, I would say that there's some subtle political, social commentary, because they really were making a statement, maybe not consciously, but ultimately looking back on history, you know, why we say that they, you know, they're a really important part of not only LGBT history, but American popular culture. Because look at what RuPaul has done, a multi-million, if not billion-dollar business. It comes into everyone's homes. It's entertaining. It's fun.
And as you mentioned, the Jukebox Revue was performing to straight audiences. There wasn't really a network of drag clubs they could have frequented.
You know,
when they
the unfortunate yeah. thing about it, but it was a reflection of the times. You know, they couldn't travel down south because they were, but they also had this veneer that they had to market themselves. All the performers had Mr. in front of their name, and they were, you know, promoted as being married, straight, which really wasn't true. They were actually queer artists, but it got Pete Butts in the seats. You know, and but, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's the way it was at the time. And, you know, these guys weren't able to leave the theater dressed in drag because they would have been arrested because cross-dressing was illegal at the time. So the theater owners were very cautious in making sure that they knew, you know, make sure you get out of the drag before you go out in the streets. But There's still a few of those performers around, who talk about those days and the camaraderie and the closeness of that troupe. Can you imagine, though, for 30 years? It's just really hard to fathom, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, I appreciate you being here today to discuss the Jewel Box Review and also to share some of your experiences here in your historic career in Indianapolis media and broadcasting. Any final thoughts you want to share before we go?
No, I just hope that people come and see the show, but also support the Indy Fringe Festival. Everything and anything that that floats their boat, they'll find at the festival. You know, there's a lot of it's edgy. You're going to find magic. You're going to find plays and musicals, multimedia. And most importantly, it's a way to support local artists.
Thank you so much, Tom, for being here today.
Thank you.
Pleasure and honor to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you to my guest this week, Tom Alvarez, and thank you for tuning in. The Jewel Box Review 2022 is debuting this Thursday, August 18th, at the Indy Fringe Festival. Performances run until September 2nd. You can find showtimes and purchase tickets online at indiefringe.org. And be sure to check out Tom's online column series, On the Isle with Tom Alvarez, which covers all the important happenings in the Indianapolis theater scene. Let's end this week's show with another vintage track featuring a star performer from the original Jewel Box Review. From 1960, we'll hear T.C. Jones singing All in Fun. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto.
Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. There's a wonderful, wonderful tune from a show called Very Warm for Me, which kind of sums me up. All in fun, this thing was all in fun. When all is said and done, how far can we go? A cocktail, a supper, a show or two, a line in Lolly's column that links me with you. Just for laughs, this thing was just for laughs. But I would like to tell you one thing, and one thing rather seriously. Oh, here's the laugh, and when I tell you, it won't kill you. What they say, that I'm Mrs. Clean, is true.